Now you can say it after, because I started the recording.
There we go. Then I will say, this is Brenda Jones, Executive Director of RSOL, and I want to welcome everyone here this evening for another month of Advancing Advocacy. We have a wonderful guest speaker, and I appreciate everybody showing up today. I will hand the control over to Jennifer, who will be introducing Susie.
So I will welcome everyone as well. And tonight we have as our speaker, Susie. Susie, forgive me if I pronounce your last name incorrectly, Wizawadi.
Perfect.
From Vermont. And I'm not going to say a whole lot at this point, because I think that I would like Susie to, as she starts, and I'm sure she was planning to do this, kind of give us a little bit of her background and why she's kind of engaged in some of this work. And then she's going to present just probably 10 or 15 minutes, and was really interested in us opening up for questions. So Susie, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you and let you proceed.
Great, thanks. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Brenda. Thank you all for inviting me, and thanks everybody else for joining on the call. I guess the only thing I would say about my background is that I ran for the legislature in 2008 because I had for the year before that, trying to write a book about what I was going to call the myth of punishment. I am a writer by trade, really, before that, involved in public humanities, but I had been doing programs in the prisons for off and on for a couple of decades, and just slowly come to the realization that the system wasn't working. So ran for the legislature after I tried to write this book and decide I could have more impact in the legislature. And then in 2013, I came to the conclusion that what was an obstacle to greater legislative success in Vermont was the fact that not enough people understood the system. The members of the public didn't know enough, and that we needed an organization in the state to advance reforms by educating the public about what the system was really like. So I thought maybe I could do both, but concluded after a year I couldn't, stepped down from the legislature, and since then I have been working full-time as the executive director of a nonprofit called Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform. And I have the good fortune of living in such a tiny state where my previous connections as a legislator still hold, because we have not 6 degrees of separation here, but 1 degree of separation is the joke. But it is a very small place. So that's sort of my background in brief and what brings me to this work. And, of course, the issue around sex offender registry, that's the area in which that, and the area of racial justice and the criminal justice system, are the area in which the human rights are most likely to be violated. So that's extremely important issues to us. It's not our main focus. Our main focus is criminal justice reform generally, but that includes educating people about the collateral consequences, which extend, of course, through the registries. So let me just jump into briefly what I wanted to say about what I think are the most least effective and most effective ways to talk to legislators, which is what I was asked to address. So I'm going to start with the least effective. And my plan is to go from the least to most. I want to talk first about, very briefly, group emails. RSOL doesn't seem to have the capacity yet, but may someday have the capacity to send out emails that allow people to click on a link. I'm sure you've all had seen other emails come through from other advocacy groups, whether Move On or somebody else, where you just click on a link and it sends an email to your legislator. By the way, if RSOL wants to join Nation Inside, that would allow RSOL to do that. These kinds of emails, group emails, are not the most effective way of reaching out to legislators. And it's because we all know, everybody knows, it takes the least amount of work. All you have to do is click a button, an email goes to your legislator, it has been pre-written, so they all say the same thing, they all have the same subject heading. They say, you know, support HB 211 or whatever. They take the least amount of work. They do show a legislator that there are numbers in support or opposition. But the truth is, sometimes legislators delete these without reading them. Some track them and send notes to the people who have written them. Larger offices, I think, tend to collect or be more a little more diligent about collecting the information from people who send those. So the federal offices, for example, will always send you a response if you send that kind of an email. But the smaller places are less, won't always, some may. The second kind of, a little more effective, are mass calls to a state house or a legislator's office where the intent is simply to leave a message. So this is where you say, "Hi, this is Susie Wibblewadi. Please tell Senator so-and-so to oppose S-135. And I'm not trying to talk to the senator if I'm calling as a citizen. I'm just trying to leave a message." And this could be calling their office, or in a smaller place, it would be calling the state house directly, and I'd be leaving a message with the sergeant at arms or with a staffer. This matters particularly when you're trying to counter the other side of an issue and you know that they are organizing and having people call in. But again, here it's about the numbers and not about personal stories that change hearts and minds. So, and this is a really important distinction, that legislators, of course, pay attention to numbers, but it's not going to change how they think. So it's not hard to do. It has more impact than mass emails, but you may or may not get a response back, depending on the size of the legislature. Now, so here's this next category of reaching out directly to legislators. This is where we all can be more effective. And this is whether you're reaching out by phone or in person. So let's start with, so by phone, whether you're calling an office or at home. And I want to stress that in states, small states where you have people's home numbers, where they're listed on their websites or their cell phone, don't be afraid to call. The public is really reluctant to call legislators at home. But if you have their home number, don't be afraid to. It's in smaller states, this is an extremely effective way to reach people. Now, you want to be judicious in the way that you use this, obviously, but so few people do it, and legislators do care so much about what their constituents think. That it's, this can be a really, really valuable way to talk to people. Now, you want to be brief, right? So you say what you're calling, what you want. So I would call as a citizen. I'd say, "Hi, so-and-so. My name is Susie Wibblewadi. I live in your district, and I'm calling to ask you to support H-73, whatever. You know, do you have time to hear why?" No. At that point, they say, "Actually, no, I'm in the middle of dinner. Thank you very much for calling. Talk to you another time." Or they say, yeah, "I'd actually really like to hear why you support that, because it's a pretty controversial bill, and it would be helpful to me." And then you get a few minutes to talk to them. Or I'm calling and I'm saying, "Hi, my name is Susie Wibblewadi. I'm calling about H-73. This is a really important bill to me. It affects me and my family directly, and I'd really like to tell you why. Is this a good time?" "Yes, no." "No, it's not a good time. Well, could we set up a time to talk later?" Or, "Yeah, this is a fine time." And then you take a few minutes. If I'm calling the office, I would say, "Hi, my name is Susie Wibblewadi. I'd like to help Senator so-and-so understand why S-95 is so important to me or my family or whoever. Could I make an appointment to see him or her for a few minutes?" "Yes or no?" "No, the senator is way too busy, but you can come in and talk to an aide." "Great. I'd like, when can I do that?" Or, "Yes, you can come in. When would you like to come?" If you can meet with an aide, that's great. The aides talk to legislators and tell them what you said. That's fine. Or if you can talk to them on the phone, that's also fine. Now, so you're telling your story. What is the most important thing about telling your story? So if I'm listening to somebody's story, the danger is that the person is going to go on and on. Because what I am listening for as a legislator, when somebody's telling me what their story is I want to know what you want. Now I'm speaking as a legislator. I want to know what you want me to do. What's your position and what do you want? The people who call up and go on and on for 5 minutes about their story, and I'm still trying to figure out where they stand and what they want me to do, that's really difficult. So what you want is to emphasize why a bill matters to you, how it will affect you, and be very clear and specific about what you want. I'm calling to ask you to support X bill or to oppose X bill. Why it matters to you, how it will affect you. Be careful about not going into irrelevant details about your particular case. Be succinct, but speak from the heart. So this can be tricky for some people, because for some people the heart of it lies in this the adding on of injustices one after another. As an advocate, I hear stories, every week. I hear lots of stories with lots of details about one injustice after another. Those aren't helpful to a legislator. The legislator wants to know, what do you want me to do, and help me know why that's the best thing to do. So you want a good way to practice this succinct storytelling of your particular story, because again, that what you want here is to be personal. Why this matters to me, the individual calling, and therefore, why it might matter to you, Mr. or Ms. Legislator. Tell your story to your phone and play it back. People don't know how much they ramble. I think we all can ramble without being really aware of it. So even if you live in a tiny district, your legislator, has thousands of constituents, all of whom have different issues, and he or she may have hundreds of thousands of constituents. So you do want to be brief, and you want to try to grab their hearts by telling your heartfelt story. What about facts? Okay, you want to have facts at the ready if asked, but you don't need to go into the facts, because the legislator, first of all, may know the facts, and even if they don't, it's hard to take facts in, but it's not hard to take in the emotional heart of a story. So if you do have facts and you are asked about facts, know the sources of your facts, because legislators don't want to hear what you think about the facts. They want to know how they can pass those facts along with sources, because they'll be questioned about them. And finally, just to emphasize again, to be super clear about what you want them to do. Oh, and by the way, you never want to threaten a legislator. You never want to say to a legislator, I'm not going to vote for you unless you do such and such. You want to be as positive as possible. You want to thank them for their support, thank them for listening, and you hope that they will do blah, 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 what you want them to do. One other thing here about in speaking with them around, if you happen to be part of an effort that involves petitions or postcards. Petitions and postcards actually are not all that useful to legislators because, again, they're not stories that have a heart. They're just numbers. They're very useful to advocates as an organizing tool to collect names for a mailing list. And, of course, if you're part of a group that's collected a lot of numbers, by all means you want to share them. But I would say be wary of petitions that have small numbers of people signing them, because that can actually be counterproductive. Legislators know that you can, go to your friends and relatives and get 50, 100 signatures from just your local networks. Unless you live in a really teeny tiny district, that's not going to have much of an impact. So, in my experience, the petitions and postcards don't really have much of an impact, because it's easy to sign a petition and it's easy to sign a postcard. Okay, and finally, the last thing I want to mention is about hearings. If you talk to a sympathetic legislator, he or she might very well say, great, this is really helpful to know. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Would you be willing to come in and testify to my committee? And in some places, by the way, you don't have to be asked. You can actually ask yourself you yourself can ask to testify before a committee. Some committee chairs will say, no, we only by invitation. But others will say, other committee chairs that are more generous will say, yeah, you want to testify on this bill? Okay. And, of course, if there's a public hearing where you come and sign up to testify, that's always, always a good idea to do if you're able to do it, if you're willing to do it, or if somebody can do it for you, if you can't be public in that way. So here are just a couple things about speaking at a hearing. Brief, be brief, personal. You want to tell the story really simply. You don't want to linger on your credentials. I can't tell you how many people have come in before the Judiciary Committee that I was on and spent 5 minutes talking about, you know, all their credentials, their degrees, the organizations they've led or whatever. Nobody cares about that. And you don't ever want to ask for money for your organization either. What you want is to say, here's who I am. This is my experience. This is why this matters to me. This is why this matters to my family, to my loved ones. This is the impact that this will have or not have, positive or negative. You want to have a handout of your major points, but you don't want to read it. And again, you want to have facts and evidence, but not depend on them terribly heavily because they're hard to take in the hearing. And you can leave those facts and evidence with the legislators to go over later and to use. And then finally, in testifying, it's really worthwhile for you to know, if you are able to testify, to never be afraid to say, I don't know what the answer to that is. I'll get back to you if I can find out. I've heard people be asked questions, and you can see that they don't really know, but they're sort of guessing or fudging. And you know, legislative hearing is not the place to do that. Legislative hearing is the place to say, geez, don't know the answer to that one, but I will see what I can find out. And then again, always thank them for their interest, thank them for listening. You want to approach them as potential allies, as in, hey, we're all in this together. I'm not thinking of you guys as adversaries, even though you may know some of them actually are adversaries. We're all in this together. We're all trying to do the best thing, and approach them with that attitude. And that goes a long way towards sort of minimizing any antagonism that people might feel towards you when you are initially coming in because you're a representative of some, you know, radical organization, or you're on the other side of the issue, they think, because you want them to see you as a person who also sees them as a person, and not no demonization either direction, right, is what we're looking for here. No demonization of the politicians and no demonization of people who are caring about sex offender issues. So I think those are the main points that I wanted to make. I'd love to hear any responses, conversation. Open it up to everybody who's listening.
Thank you, Susan. This is Brenda. I was jotting some things down. I've done some similar presentations of my own in the past. I liked your idea of the recording yourself telling the story. I've used that myself. I never tried doing it just to see how long it takes me to tell the story. But in our legislature, we tend to have a 3-minute rule in most of the committees. So we all had to make sure that anything we were planning to say could be said in 3 minutes. Because mm-hmm. You never know when somebody's going to be, you know, really hard-nosed about it and say, look, time's up. You got one more sentence. Sorry, bye. So we would, I would always encourage people to do it for that. I love your idea, and I think that if a person is going to tell a story, what a great idea to, most phones have a little record feature on them. Just turn it on, pretend you're trying to talk to your legislator, or go ahead and write it down and then say it out loud, whatever you want to do, and see how long it takes you. And you'd be surprised how many things you really didn't have to say to get that down to that key few bits. Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. Is that something that you had to learn the hard way, or did you hear that from someone else?
I learned it from a friend of mine who is a teacher who uses that with students in teaching storytelling, actually, to help people learn what they sound like and the fact that we actually underestimate how long we talk.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely do. People are often surprised, and I find if I don't practice and run through what I'm trying to say, I get up there, and if I get off, and then I get off script, that 3 minutes is gone.
Yeah.
It goes
yeah.
by in a heartbeat. It really
yeah.
does.
Yeah.
And I'm usually sorry. Yeah, definitely.
Right.
I was also fascinated that it sounds like in Vermont, the chairs of the committees, it's at their discretion whether someone can speak. They have to be invited. Is
they
that
don't
how it works
well,
there?
It depends on the chair. In the House Judiciary Committee, under the chair who was the chair for many, many years and under whom I served, he would let anybody who wanted to speak. But the woman who is in charge of the Corrections Committee does not feel that way. Some people are, I guess people are told, no, there's no time for you to speak. But Bill
wow.
Lippert always found time for people to speak, and he took the time. So I guess it depends on the committee chair.
Yeah, and now in Maryland, where I'm from, it's anybody who signs up gets to speak. They get their 3 minutes. At least, and
yes,
you
that's
do
because
have
you've got
to
the 3 minute
sign.
Rule. That, yeah,
yeah.
That helps.
Now they don't always follow it strictly, but you get to stand if you signed up, and you have to sign up like no later than a half an hour beforehand. And if you have things that you want to be handed out to them, you have to have that like an hour beforehand, dropped off at the office. But if you have signed up, they will call you, and you will have your 3 minutes.
Are you talking about a public hearing?
The hearing.
Or a committee hearing?
When the bill is being heard. When the bill is being brought up for consideration, there must be a hearing in my state. And so at that point, they'll say, we're now hearing House Bill, 32, and we're going to start calling the people who are in favor, and then it's up to the chair what order they do it. It's usually in favor first and then opposed, and then everybody gets a chance to have their, the first person up is usually the sponsor, and then then others present on it.
Yeah.
Talking about something different, or is that?
We have committee hearings and public hearings, and most bills only have committee hearings. And, most bills don't have that many people who want to speak about them. If an issue is really controversial, then there would be a public hearing with, where there might be, in that case, you would have 2 minute limits and you might have 100 people who want to speak and it would be held in the House chamber.
At this special location.
Otherwise,
that's interesting.
The 10 or 20 people who want to speak are usually allowed to just speak. It's arranged in
advance. Yeah, it sounds like in Maryland, it's rare that there's a special hearing. I guess it could be done. We will have some bills with nobody up there but the sponsor, that'll present the bill, and then the committee will ask some questions, and they'll sit down. And then, yes, there'll be the others where there'll be hundreds. When we were legalizing marijuana, oh boy, that went on all afternoon. But we're trying to.
Yeah.
So it does vary with the topic, certainly.
Yeah.
But I find it fascinating how different it could be from state to state, just in how people get permission.
Yeah.
Jennifer, do you have any questions before we open it up?
Yeah, I'll ask a question, and then we may have one in the queue. I'm going to check. Susie, I've testified before a committee in my state in Kentucky, and I've done it once. And when I did that, my mother was telling someone I had gone and done that, and this person said, oh, my God, were they nice to her? And, in fact, I had a fairly good experience. So what would be your suggestion for someone who does, you know, with a controversial issue like ours, who might encounter some animosity or, you know, just an experience where maybe a legislator is not so nice to them, even though I agree you said we're all on the same side. You got any advice on what, you know, how would a person handle that kind of situation?
Oh, you know, I'm so glad you asked that because it's true. There are among legislators people who are, you know, not necessarily particularly supportive or friendly or even, you know, civil people who can be aggressive and mean and nasty. And I've seen it happen in committees, not ever in a committee that I was in, but in other committees. And I guess the advice would be the same advice you would give to anybody encountered in that situation. Keep your cool. It's not personal. Don't take the bait. Don't get defensive. Take the high road. And, I had a therapist once who was trying to help me deal with a nasty person said, imagine the person without his clothes on. So do whatever you can do to try to minimize the power that such a person might have over you, so that you can not take it seriously and not take it personally, and just ignore the hostility and try to respond politely, always, you know, politely and civilly, as we all would as adults. And, you know, try not to get hooked by somebody's antagonism. I guess realizing that there are jerks in the legislature just like there are jerks everywhere else.
Okay. Let me see if there is somebody in the queue. So if anybody has a question, remember you can hit *6 and get in the queue. Let me see. Yes, I think we've got someone. Did we have someone with a question? Maybe that person has fallen out of the queue.
I'd love to hear anybody's thoughts or experiences that they've had, positive or negative, in trying to contact legislators or speaking at hearings or speaking before committees.
Well, I will certainly add, in my experience with speaking on this topic, speaking of sometimes troublesome issues, that it is a useful strategy, too, to when you're testifying, you definitely have to stick to whatever the bill is. It's not the time. That's not the time, really, to tell your story. Be personal. But I've often found, especially in one particular committee that has a bit of a reputation, I encourage the people who speak that to say, not only stick to the issue, but you're under no obligation to identify yourself as a registrant or even as a family member of a registrant. Stick to the facts. And if somebody does call you out on it, and there's one particular senator who loves to do this, the person will be up and speaking on a bill, and the bill, the person will say, and what was your offense?
Oh, and, gosh.
Yes. And, of course, the person, you know, no matter what they say it is, you know, the person just, and they don't go on. They just nod their head knowingly, yep, okay, we've discredited him. So I say you're under no obligation to answer that question. You know, you can simply politely say, again, keep your cool, just politely say, with all due respect, you know, that's not at issue here. What's at issue here is the matter of this bill, which does such and so, and, you know, put it back on in that direction.
Yeah.
And not to bring it up, but so I do stress that because it's generally not relevant to the bill at
all. Yes, and you know, thank you for making that distinction. So when I let me clarify. So when I was saying tell your story, what I actually mean by that is not to tell the story of your particular past personal experience, but how this might affect you or affect people you know in any positive or negative way. If you can speak in that way personally without... I see the complexity here.
Yeah, it is very tricky. And it can be very powerful, especially with a family member. That's my experience, and you could probably back that up on any number of issues, not just ours. But to have a spouse, a parent, a child, if not a young child, you know, grown child or teenager, who can come in and speak to how a bill is going to be harmful to them, you know, directly. It does say volumes, but you can do it as a registrant, and we combated Halloween bills that way. The ones that speaking of Halloween, they tried to pass a bill several years ago now, similar to the ones we hear about that would have basically it was a bill that would have outlawed. I mean, you wouldn't be allowed to celebrate. I mean, I think that was the word they used. Celebrate Halloween. If you were on the registry. And our members kind of came out of the woodwork on that when we had a Wiccan come in and say, hey, you're violating my my religious freedom here. which I thought was just precious. So there's no danger in that to come out and speak. And we've had people even on supervision with permission come in and testify specifically about a bill as it related to a registry issue, you know, which is a separate issue.
So, hey, Brenda, I've got one in the queue.
Great.
Let me hit the chat. Okay. Cindy, are you there?
I am.
Oh. Ask your question, Cindy.
Well, I'm not hearing her. Are you?
No.
No.
I heard the I am, and then she was gone.
Oh, I thought that was me. I thought you said Susie, but I think you said Cindy. Cindy never said I am.
Oh, that was you. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, Cindy, we're having trouble getting people off of mute or something, maybe.
Yeah, it's showing that she's not on mute. Cindy, are you there?
Are you talking to me, Jennifer?
I am talking to you, Cindy. You were actually in the queue. Did you mean to be?
No, I haven't touched a single button. I'm listening to my iPad at my ear like a transistor radio. Hi, all. Yeah, no, not me.
Okay, well, I'll take you off there then. If anybody has a question, press star 6. I think Susie's a valuable resource for us, so... If anybody else would like to get in the queue, here we go.
Hi, my name is Sherry. I'm from Sacramento. And I just wanted to share, whenever a bill is presented in the Assembly or in the Senate, we have just a couple of minutes to say, hey, I support or I oppose this bill. I typically just kind of go in there. I only have just a few seconds. I have enough time to just say, my first name, who I represent, and if I support or oppose. So I basically just go in there and just says, my name is Sherry. I am a mother of an abuse survivor, and I strongly support or oppose this bill. Would there be anything else that you could recommend that I could say to kind of just add an additional emphasis to kind of let them hear me? I've already gone into the legislators and kind of worked with ACSOL to advocate for these bills when we were talking to the aide, but standing in front of the legislators themselves, is there anything else you could suggest that I could say in that quick little blurb that may just stand out?
Oh, that's a tough one. It would really help you if you had some legislative advocates inside the legislature. Have you not been able to connect and find some supporters within the legislature who can help you and get you connected to other legislators?
There, where I advocate with Janice, so, you know, there are some of the legislators that are sympathetic to what we have to say. But, of course, there are some that are just completely will not hear. Once you hear registered citizen, they just completely shut down. You know, in fact, when I stood up for the first time, one of the aides, one of the legislators' mouth dropped when she saw me come in there and advocate as a mother of an abuse survivor, because she wasn't seeing me coming from, you know, from left field. But I just trying to figure out a way that I could be more effective, even than just that little quick blurb. Of course, I do go in there and just kind of share my story when I talk with the aides personally in regards to why I support or oppose the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with only just a minute or two, about all she could really do, I would think, Susie, is just have one special fact. The civil right violation or the human rights issue or the, you know, some one bullet point that gets pulled.
Let me ask you something. If there was one thing that if you went really kind of dug down and were just going to speak from your heart and say one heartfelt thing about your daughter? If you say one thing about, on behalf of my daughter, who is an abuse survivor, who had a terrible experience, I feel X, Y, and I want to say X, Y, and ask you to do, you know, Z. But is there any way that you can expand that just a tiny bit to make it a little more human? My abuse survivor daughter, who is, you know, 15, 28, whatever she is, who is now a blank, who's a nurse, or who is a senior in high school, or, you know, how on her behalf I'm saying X and asking you to do this. What you're trying to do is make them realize that you are a person and she is a person, and not just a figure, not a statistic, right? So is there any way that you could add, you know, five words to that that would help?
I guess I could. I usually just try to throw, if I can, add an additional thing that these laws don't do anything to protect her or any other abuse survivor or abuse victim. I can try to throw in something else in there, you know, that she's, you know, a high school student or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I wonder,
like that.
Could she ever testify? Could she ever come in and say, I am an abuse survivor, these laws do not help me, or what would help me is X instead, you know, more money spent on prevention or something like that?
She has, when her school schedule allows for her to, she goes in and advocates. She has not been able to go into the legislative hearing, but she has come with me. We have both shared our story. And when we spoke with the aides, again, it's really hard to get in front of the legislators themselves.
Yeah. Young people have a lot of legitimacy just because by seeing the amount of courage it takes for a young person to speak in public like that is kind of understood at a gut level by legislators, I think. If she ever could, but the courage that it takes for a mother also is also understood. Oh, why are people so dense? Hey, do you know Bill Monning? He would be a supporter. He is a friend of my sister's, and I know he's not from Sacramento. I'm not sure actually what city he lives in. I think maybe LA, I'm not sure. But he would be another legislator to reach out to say, can you help me connect with any other supporters that he would know about that you wouldn't, to try to build support internally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure Janice knows majority of the legislators, if not all. I do know we have some sympathetic ones that we are gaining ground. It's a slow ground, but we are gaining momentum. So
good.
Great.
Good.
Well, I'm sure we should probably move on.
Yeah.
I think we have a couple more questions in the queue, so we should probably move on. But thanks a lot. That was a really good question and a good answer as well. So, Jennifer, do we in fact have somebody else?
Hello, this is Mary.
There you are. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you had any advice on the best way to email legislators and have them actually receive the messages. I've done this in the past, and I've done them individually to different legislators, and I've also done like a mass email to multiples. And I'm not always sure if they go through, if there's a spam filter or anything like that. So I'm just trying to figure out, is there a certain email strategy that you think helps get them to where they're visible and can elicit a response?
So what's tough about that, this is a really good question, but what's tough about it is if a legislator is getting 100 emails a day, there is not really anything that you can do to make yours stand out. And so my alternate suggestion would be to write a physical letter that goes to the legislator either at his or her home or at the office, and you can pretty much guarantee that that physical letter will get read and responded to.
Okay, great. So, thanks. I have a few that have responded via email. I was also curious, the subject line, if there's anything that's an attention getter one way or another, just because email is easy and fast and cheap. I agree with a personal letter as well. But if you did email, is there anything in the attention line and the subject line that would catch their eye any differently? Or if it's just a matter of luck, if it gets read?
I'm thinking about myself and all the emails that I get and what makes me open one. The advocates do a lot of research on what gets people to open emails by sending the same email out with three or four different subject headings and then tracking which one actually gets opened more. I think that it's sort of a big mystery. What makes me open one is some sense that it actually is an individual letter, not some kind of a mass one. So something that, here's my story, or, you probably, like the rest of us, you're getting lots of emails, political emails these days, right?
Right.
And think about
one thing I did do, I'll just share this in case anyone else is interested, is I'm a family member of someone on the registry, and we have a son. And at 10 years old, he handwrote a letter, and I scanned that in and attached it and sent that to our legislators so that it would be a personal story from his point of view and how our situation impacts him.
Yes, I think that's great. And if you could say something about your son, my son, the registrant, in the email that you're sending out, that would get me to open it too, because it's a personal story.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, then I think we're ready for the next question.
Yes, my name is Ken.
Hi, Ken.
My question is, here I'm from Nebraska, Nebraska Unafraid, and there's a lot of prison problems here, and I suspect the legislation this year is going to want to do a bill on prison reform. Who should I start talking to? Should I start talking to the Attorney General, to the head of the Prison Bureau, or the legislatures? Our head of the Judicial Committee was termed out, so I don't know even who's going to be head of the Judicial Committee. But how do these bills start, and how can I get my influence on it from the beginning so we're not fighting something at the end which says all people can be let out except sex offenders?
I don't know how to answer that without knowing who would be initiating the bill. If you could find out, if you can, if you know, have any connections in any of those places, I would put out my feelers and try to find out which legislator might be sponsoring this bill. Where's the bill initiating? Is it initiating from the judiciary or from the executive branch, or from the Department of Corrections, or from where? And then try to see if you could get involved in. It's of course wonderful to be involved on the ground floor if you can, if anybody will let you participate. But if there's any kind of a coalition of folks who might be involved in it, or if you have a victims group that by any chance you've made connections with, because they're always strong opponents, so they're good to try to work into allies. Because any of those different groups could have initiated the bill. So, where did it come from? It's what you need to know in order to know how to get in on the ground floor to help the conversation from the beginning.
Thank you.
Okay, good luck.
Okay, we're ready for our next person then. Thanks, Ken.
I'm wanting to follow up on that question on the woman who spoke two people before about a abuse survivor, and I was interested in why an abuse survivor would be speaking. Was the person who was the abuser a relative, or has she got a higher view that the laws really don't protect people who are going to be abused? I'd like to know if that's possible. So, no.
Is this the first time you've heard of somebody who's a survivor that might be standing up and testifying?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. This is Brenda again, in case you haven't recognized my voice yet. I can tell you from the experience being involved in this movement, there are a lot of abuse survivors that are out there involved. Sometimes they're the registrants. Sometimes they're a family member. And the abuse is sometimes the same and sometimes different. I don't know if
would come in and testify.
Yeah, I can tell. And kind of tying back in with the suggestion that the 15-year-old to come in and testify. There was one family where the situation was two foster kids. A foster daughter and a foster son who's a little bit older with a slight developmental disability, and he had molested the sister who was a year or two younger, and they given him a light sentence, whatever, but he was on the registry, and it was in some bill that was being heard was potentially impacting him. The two of them had forgiven each other, trying to move on, etc. But she was able to come in and speak to that issue. I'm moving on. I've forgiven. This situation isn't right. It's affecting me, and it was terribly affecting her because she was in a very small town, and it was not secret. So she was a powerful speaker.
Add to that.
Go ahead, Susie. Please.
Absolutely. Yeah. The nationally, I think it's really important for us to all know that the victims' rights movement has really begun to shift the national conversation because of an awareness that the laws against domestic and sexual violence have not worked to bring satisfactions, particularly to victims, and they haven't done anything to reduce domestic and sexual violence, and therefore the push to criminalize domestic and sexual violence that was so crucial to the women's movement, 20, 30 years ago, is being looked at in a different way. To think, should, and also because there are racial disparities in the way that the laws are implemented and the way people are prosecuted. So if it's not particularly helpful to families, and there's no reduction in this interpersonal harm in this way, then maybe it's worth the people in the, particularly the leaders of the victims' rights movement to around the country to start rethinking our policies around domestic and sexual violence both. Especially because just what you're talking about, this it isn't always a benefit to families to be criminalizing behaviors that result in people going to jail or now, of course, much worse because of the registries. And that's a positive outcome of the last few years that I think is sort of still a little bit under the radar because it's still controversial.
Well, my wife, who is a therapist, or used to be a therapist, says there's a difference between interfamily abuse like that and outsiders of the family. Is that recognized? I mean,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I would add that since interfamily is far, far more common, what used to happen before we got so punitive and throwing registries and keeping families separated was there was a lot more effort, when possible, to look for ways for reunification, for the person to be able to reintegrate where it was appropriate, where there was lots of therapy going on, everybody in the family agreed it was a good idea. And, so back in the day, there was more connection. And I think some are seeing that we're missing an opportunity. It's not always appropriate, of course, but it's more appropriate than, more often appropriate than people think it is. So,
absolutely.
And
the overemphasis on stranger danger, particularly with respect to kids, deflects attention from the real issues of what goes on sometimes in families. And that's where the attention needs to be in order to keep children safe.
Exactly. Teaching families to recognize it and encourage kids to be able to come talk about it, the harsh sentences that we've got are part of the reason that some don't.
Exactly.
Because
that
they
is
don't,
what keeps people from coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a big, big deal. And I don't know how much, it's hard to quantify what doesn't happen, meaning the people who don't report.
Right.
But
it's
pretty likely to be a sizable chunk. Okay, I think we do have one more person in the queue, if that's all right. Thank you very much for your call.
Hi, this is Michael from Indiana. I was just wondering how you set up a testimony, if you have a testimony or somebody willing to testify about certain legislation and its impact, how would you set that up?
Well, so every state is different, Michael. So I don't know, of course, exactly how Indiana works. But if I were you in Indiana and I wanted to testify, I would contact the committee that I wanted to testify before, that the bill would be that's coming up before, the committee assistant or the whoever administers the committee, and ask them what's the procedure here, what's the protocol in your committee for people to testify, because I would like to testify, and ask them directly. And if you don't know who the committee assistant or person is, you can call the sergeant-at-arms at the legislature in Indiana and ask them, and they'll be able to tell you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
Good luck.
Information on their website, some of it general, some of it specific, and there's usually an entire department dedicated to helping citizens find their way around the legislature and figure out how to testify and such. So be sure to take a good look around on your state legislature's website. You may find some good resources there. Some of them may even be aimed at kids, but they're very helpful if you're not familiar with it. So,
and that's going to depend widely from state to state, too.
Yes, it does.
Hello.
It varies widely. Yeah.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hello. Yeah, I was one more in the queue here. I had a question.
Uh-huh. Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Greg from Alabama. What I wanted to touch on was the subject of having an abuse victim testify. And I think what we're talking about here is the, just as an example, the Romeo and Juliet type of a situation where the victim and the perpetrator allegedly are both volunteering for their relationship, and they're happy with their relationship, and there's not any real abuse going on, but the state or the governing authority manufactures a criminal, and then prosecutes it even at the resistance or against the wishes of the alleged victim. So they make a victim and they make an abuser out of persons that are actually volunteering for the relationship. And it could span, it could be a parent and a child or anything. It could be not real abuse happen, but it could the state just wants to manufacture the idea of abuse. And so you get what they call an abuse victim coming in to testify against the abuse of the state. More or less the state is abusing its power and to make criminals when there are really no criminals activity and there's no real danger or there's no real harm to anyone. They have the term abuse victim, but it's actually there was no real abuse, but they just go by the name abuse victim. Is that the correct understanding of when you have an abuse victim who's testifying against the overzealous laws?
I'd say it goes beyond that. For one thing, though, I hope no parent ever comes forward and says it wasn't abuse if it was a child. But anyway, the experience that I've had has actually not been Romeo Juliet. We had one lady who got up. She was raped a couple of times as a teenager. The reason she had come forward and was testifying was because she had a brother who was on the registry. But she was able to speak as saying, and she would say, I'm a survivor, not a victim.
Yes.
But she would say, and when somebody would get in our face, that she would come back and she would say, look, I've been there. So don't tell me, she could say, don't tell me that the victim's life is over. It's changed. That's the kind of thing.
Yeah.
So so it wasn't just that situation. And I would also argue that the best testimony is more as what Susie has been saying. The best testimony is not the people who get up and say, you guys have created horrible laws. It's the ones who get up and say, my impact is, with I statements, my story is this. When you get up there and you're accusing people of creating horrible laws, you lose them. Susie, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I agree completely. Mhm. Yeah. That's the quickest way to turn off legislators. Yeah. But the Romeo and Juliet story, those are real. But again, I think as Sandy is saying, that the best approach there is this is how this has impacted me. I mean, and there are stories about people who are somebody who's convicted under so-called Romeo and Juliet scenario who then marry and, live happily together for 20 years, and meanwhile that one of them is on the registry the whole time. Those are very compelling stories, and we're a long way from getting rid of the registries, or maybe not so long, but those are the stories that will help ultimately get rid of the registries, I think, and it helped with the change of laws so that the age range can change in various states. We've done that in Vermont, so that if there's less than if there's 3 years, anywhere less than 3 years difference between the two people, and the youngest is at least 15, there's no there's no crime. So there are changes that can be made around this with this specific kind of scenario. Those are tricky.
They are indeed.
Anybody else?
I can testify.
Yeah.
I don't believe we have any more.
Nope.
Is that right? All good? All right. And we're coming up in about an hour, which is short for us, but not too short. And so if just a last call, if anybody has any other remaining question. Otherwise, we'll wrap up.
Or any final thoughts that you, either of you have, either Sandy or Jennifer, any final thoughts?
Well, this is Brenda. Sandy's not on the call.
Brenda, okay. That's what I meant. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm glad to be Sandy, too. I like her.
Susie, I would just say thank you for giving us your perspective from my own personal experience. Those personal stories have a lot of impact. So I think if anything that people should take away from your message tonight is not to be afraid to tell their story.
Yeah, to the extent that they can. Yeah.
Right.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And definitely practice your story so that you can say it as an elevator speech.
Yeah.
Someone just hey Brenda. Someone just asked on the chat if they can get Susie's contact info.
Susie,
absolutely.
Do you have any? Okay.
Yeah.
You'll have to say it out loud. If you're okay saying it out loud, that'd be fine. Whatever
sure,
you're comfortable
yeah.
giving.
I'm happy for people to have my contact info. It's long, so I'll say it twice. It's Wizawati, which is my last name. W-I-Z as in zebra, O-W-A-T as in Tom, Y, Wizawati, at VermontersForCriminalJusticeReform.org, all spelled out. That's VermontersForCriminalJusticeReform.org. And I think the name is in the last email. My name is in the last email that you guys sent out from RSOL, and so people can. I'm the only one with that name, so you can Google it, and it'll come up to me if you lose the contact info.
Excellent. Vermonters for Social Justice.
Vermonters
criminal
for
justice.
Criminal Justice Reform.
Criminal Justice Reform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so very, very much, and I think this has been a great hour that we've shared together, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
The recording.
All right.
Recording.